Hi there. If you're hearing this, that means you haven't yet upgraded to the Missive feed and you're only hearing partial episodes of Founders. If you'd like to access every full episode, you can upgrade by tapping the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player or by going to founderspodcast.com. The best way to support Founders is by investing in an annual subscription. You save 18% and it works out to less than a dollar a week to learn from some of the greatest minds in history. The monthly option is only $5 a month if you'd prefer that. And every subscription comes with a 7-day free trial so you can get the full experience. I'm doing something new though to encourage you to make a commitment. If you choose the annual plan, this is only for the annual plan, I will email you personally a private podcast feed called Founders Postscript. This is in addition to the Misfit feed. It's a bonus for those that choose the annual plan. I just released a new episode on the Founders Postscript feed, based on a book that Elon Musk recommended called The Lessons of History. You can upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes or going to founderspodcast.com, and I hope to see you on the Misfit feed. One day in the early 1950s, Walt Disney stood looking out over 240 acres of farmland in Anaheim, California, and imagined building a park where people could live among Mickey Mouse and Snow White in a world still powered by steam and fire for a day or a week, or if the visitor is slightly mad, forever. Despite his fame and success, exactly no one wanted Disney to build such a park. Not his brother Roy, who ran the company's finances, not the bankers, and not his wife Lillian. Amusement parks at that time were a generally despised business. Disney was told that he would be headed towards financial ruin. But Walt persevered, initially financing the park against his own life insurance policy. He assembled a talented team of engineers, architects, artists, animators, landscapers, and even a retired admiral to transform his ideas into a soaring yet soothing wonderland. The catch was that they only had a year and a day in which to build it. On July 17, 1955, Disneyland opened its gates, and the first day was a disaster. Disney was nearly suicidal with grief that he had failed on a grand scale. But the curious masses kept coming, and the rest is entertainment history. 800 million visitors have flocked to the iconic park since then. In Disney's Land, popular historian Richard Snow brilliantly presents the entire spectacular story, a wild ride from vision to realization that reflects the uniqueness of the man determined to build the happiest place on earth. With a watchmaker's precision, an artist's conviction, and the desperate, high-hearted recklessness of a riverboat gambler. That was from the back cover of the book that I'm going to talk to you about today, which is Disney's Land, Walt Disney and the Invention of the Amusement Park That Changed the World. And it was written by Richard Snow. So I actually found this book. I wasn't expecting to do this book this week. I was in a bookstore just randomly looking through the biography in the business section. And I saw this book, I picked it up, read that back cover, I was like, oh, I'm going to buy this right now. And I started reading it and I couldn't put it down. So that's a great indicator that that's the book that I should be talking about this week. And what I didn't realize until after I had already started reading the book was that I had read another one of Richard Snow's books. So I think all the way back on Founders number 8 maybe, I read his book called I Invented the Modern Age, The Rise of Henry Ford. And there's a paragraph in that book that I thought was just hilarious. It's how he came up with the name of that book. I'm just going to read it to you real quick. One day towards the end of his life, Ford was talking with a local high school boy named John Dallinger, and they got onto the subject of education. Ford spoke of the virtues of the McGruffey's reader era. That's how he educated himself when he was younger. And that sounded pretty futzy to Dallinger. But sir, he protested, these are different times. This is the modern age. And, young man, Ford snapped, I invented the modern age. The claim is as preposterous as it is megalomaniacal. It is also largely true. That's one of my favorite paragraphs that Richard Snow ever wrote. I thought it was fantastic the way he summed that up. So back to Disney. This is the third book I read on him. I was actually shocked. I went back. So I've done Founders number 2 and Founders number 39 on Disney. And I cannot believe I let this much time pass before reading another book on him. He's one of the most influential entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs to ever live. I want to read this quote that's at the very beginning of the book, which I found remarkable because when I read Triumph of the American Imagination by Neil Gabler, That was the one, the book I covered on. It's the most comprehensive biography of Walt Disney I think ever written. It was on Founders number 2. I was really shocked, you know, because going into that book, I knew of Disney, you know, through animation, through cartoons. I didn't know his favorite project he ever worked on was Disneyland. And so I want to read this quote that's right at the beginning of the book. He says, "When he reached middle age, it seemed that we were going to witness an all too familiar process. The conversion of the tired artist into the tired businessman. When in 1955 we heard that Disney had opened an amusement park under his own name, it appeared certain that we would not look forward to anything new from Mr. Disney. We were quite wrong. He had, instead, created his masterpiece." So I want to start with a good way to think about the importance of Disneyland and then getting into Walt's early life. So it says, "Disneyland is the extension of the powerful personality of one man. It is not, like many perfectly good modern theme parks, a consensus on what might make a nice place." So if you're, this is the first time you're studying and learning about Walt Disney, he's an obsessive with Soul in the Game. I put him up there with people, the fanatical people that were very concerned about the quality of their products, like Steve Jobs, Enzo Ferrari, Henry Royce of Rolls-Royce fame. He's the same exact breed of person. And so the idea that he's going to design from consensus is just not going to happen. At the age of 9, Walt was climbing out of bed every morning at 3:30 in the morning to go to work. He was delivering newspapers in the snow. Disney's father didn't believe children should have toys. "But on nice mornings, I used to come to houses with those big old porches, and the kids would have left some of their toys out. I would find them and play with them there on the porch at 4 in the morning, when it was just barely getting light. Then I'd have to tear back and go back to my paper route again." More about his father, his joyless father. His father incubated a peculiar, joyless blend of grim Protestant work ethic and socialism. His mother did her best to soften things for the boys, sometimes handing them slices of bread buttered on the bottom so their father wouldn't see them being spoiled with such a luxury. So his father's a very hard man, just like Disney winds up being very stingy with praise. And as soon as all of his sons got to the age, they try to go as far away from him as possible. So it gives you an idea of his early life. Does not sound like a very nice person to be around. Their farm, this is before they moved to the city. They're working at the farm. Disney's really young. Their farm, like every farm, demanded hard work, which in this case was thankless. Elias Disney, that's his father's name, believed that using fertilizer on a crop was like giving whiskey to an alcoholic. He refused to do it, with the predictable results. And this is where the author goes into, like, growing up in this kind of environment, how this probably influenced what Disney chose to work on later in his life. "For one who spent so much of his working life celebrating the virtues of family, he was eager to get away from his. He was turned down by the army because of his youth, so he forged an earlier date on his birth certificate, and in September of 1918, the 16-year-old joined the Red Cross as an ambulance driver. He arrived in France shortly after." What was very surprising to me, I read the biography of Ray Kroc, the founder of the McDonald's franchise system, and he talked about he volunteered for the Red Cross, and he served in France during World War I, and he says there was this strange kid. This is in his book, Grinding It Out. He says there was a strange kid that when we all went out and, you know, got drinks or went out to party at night, he would stay back in the barracks and draw cartoons. He's like, his name was Walt Disney. So they actually served in the same Red Cross division, which was interesting. He comes back after the war's over. He talked his way into an enterprise called the Pesman Rubin Commercial Art Studio. This is where he starts drawing and doing marketing for companies. For a few weeks, he had a fine time making advertising layouts, writing copy, and designing program covers for local movie houses. Disney, this was a seasonal job. So he winds up getting let go. Disney was out on the January streets along with another brief hire. This is somebody becomes rather important. It's just one of his first business partners. This is a guy named Oob Earworks. Have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, by the way. Disney liked Earworks and suggested the optimistic idea that they form a partnership. They did. The fetal business foundered in weeks, but Disney wrangled a job that's... He has, I think, at least two failed companies before he starts the Disney company, maybe even three. The fetal business foundered in weeks, but Disney wrangled a job at the Kansas City Film Ad Company. So before he moves to California, he's in Kansas City. And soon he got the firm to hire Earworks. Their new employer produced minute-long promotional films for local businesses that ran in the city's movie houses. Even for that morning time of animation, the very beginning days of the animation industry, these were crude. Disney, now this, the reason I bring this up is because the next paragraph, this is something Disney does his entire life. Disney immediately sought more advanced technology, as he would for the rest of his career. He found books on animation, borrowed a camera, and started experimenting. He was, from the time he starts working till the time he dies, he's always focused on improving his work. Soon he was producing short cartoons, cartoon ads that he called Laughograms. And then he made longer cartoons drawn from fairy tales. He went bankrupt in 1923 after completing an ambitious project called Alice's Wonderland. But he doesn't give up there. He sends out his work on Alice's Wonderland to a film distributor. He sent it to a film distributor named Margaret Winkler. She gave Disney a contract to make 6 Alice episodes. So these are the very first cartoons he's making. He began hiring a larger staff and persuaded Oob Earworks to join him again. Alice's in Wonderland ran out of steam in 1927. Margaret Winkler had then turned over the distribution business to her husband, Charles Mintz. This guy is going to be a scumbag. And a theme that we see through all these books is they're constantly lecturing us that you need to control anything that's important to your business or your work, you should control it. Disney says the same things. It's because this guy is going to wind up ripping him off. Who urged Disney to come up with something new that he could market through Universal Pictures. Disney responded with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, which proved a solid success. He confidently went to meet with Mintz and asked for more money. Mintz offered him less money. Disney indignantly refused and discovered that not only did Universal own the rights to Oswald, therefore Disney didn't have control, but that Mintz had hired away his entire animation staff. The steely distributor told him, either you come with me at my price or I'll take your organization away from you. Disney never hesitated. You're not going to say that to somebody like Walt Disney. So he's like, all right, I'm out of here. I'm not coming with you. I'm going to start brand new. This is the lore of the creation of Mickey Mouse. He takes this long train ride back to California from New York City. He's with his wife. And on this, the myth, it could be true. It's purported to be true. That on that train ride is when he draws Mickey Mouse. He wants to name it Mortimer Mouse. And his wife's like, that's the stupidest name ever. Like, that's a terrible name. And she actually gave him the name Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse was introduced to the world. For his third Mickey short, Disney hired an orchestra. And Steamboat Willie was the first sound cartoon. So we see him constantly wanting to innovate. He made the first sound cartoon. He doesn't stop there. And what's amazing about the career of Walt Disney is once he does something, he gets bored. He's not like, I'm not gonna sit here and just make more sound cartoons. Then I'll make feature-length films. And he just keeps going and going and always trying to expound on his ideas. Mickey Mouse has a bigger following. Talking about how successful Mickey Mouse, you know, he built his entire empire. Later in his life, Disney has a great quote. He's like, I hope we never forget that it all started with a mouse. So anyways, this Hollywood reporter is talking about how important Mickey Mouse, like how big it was. He says Mickey Mouse has a bigger following than 9/10 of the stars in Hollywood. Disney's cartoons became subtler and more fluent. He added color to them and began to garner Academy Awards. In 1933, now keep in mind, this is 22 years before he starts working on Disneyland, right? In 1933, he released what one media historian has called the most successful short animation of all time. That's The Three Little Pigs. The whole story of Disney is just one innovation after another, one accolade after another. It's really remarkable. Urged to make a sequel of The Three Little Pigs, he declined. His terse refusal, a fine showing business apothegm. I don't know how to pronounce that word, but it's like a short saying. You can't top pigs with pigs. He was tiring of making short films. In 1934, he embarked on making the first feature-length cartoon. He had budgeted $500,000 for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It ended up consuming $1.5 million. He was terrible at numbers. He has another great quote. He's like, we're innovating. I'll tell you what it costs when we're done. Same thing. I think he said he thought Disneyland was going to cost him like $1.5 million, something like that. Let's say $2 million maybe. And it wound up being $17 million, which I think is the equivalent of like $160 million today. So this is not surprising. He's like, yeah, Snow White. I'll do it for, I think I could do it for $500,000. Winds up being, what, 3 times that? So it takes $1.5 million in 4 years. By the time it was released in 1937, it had become known as in Hollywood as Disney's Folly, right? That's why it's like, oh, this guy's going to fail. Wrong. Snow White was a triumph, the biggest hit of 1938, and the most profitable sound film ever made. The next couple of years were the most satisfying Disney would know until he began to toy with the idea of an amusement park. Things soured for him quickly. His next two features performed tepidly at the box office, partly because of the war, that's World War II, partly because the war choked off his European market. Revenues dwindled, and he had to take his company public. He almost lost his company, actually. And deep salary cuts triggered an ugly strike at the studio. The strike only lasted 5 weeks, but it left Disney with a lifelong grievance, one thing that he never got over. And this is where the point of his life, where he's looking for something new. He's not satisfied with his work anymore. He kind of goes off into like hobbies, and I wouldn't say he becomes a recluse, but he's definitely withdrawn from the studio. This is what his daughter, Diane, wrote about this time. I think it was just after the war when nothing seemed to stimulate him. I could sort of sense it. I could tell he wasn't pleased with anything he was doing. One small enterprise did please him, though, and it had little to do with the art that he had done so much to invent and of which he was the undisputed master. That is a hell of a sentence. The art he had done so much to invent and of which he was the undisputed master. Completely turned his back on animation. He was dismayed. So this is some guy comes to visit him, a film critic. I think he's at his house. He says he was dismayed to find the man whose work he had long admired seemed totally uninterested in movies and seemed wholly, almost weirdly concerned with the building of a miniature railroad engine and a string of cars. I'm going to pause here. I'll finish the rest of the sentence in a minute. That's when I first read his Neil Gabler's book. I was like, why is this guy spending so much time building this miniature replica of a railroad? I thought it was the weirdest midlife crisis one could have. All of his zest for invention, for creative fantasies, seemed to be going into this plaything. And what's really interesting is talking about how he felt before he found something he could pour all his love in. This is what I meant about an obsessive, a soul in the game. If they don't have an outlet, the professional outlet is what they value most in life besides their family. And in some cases, like Enzo Ferrari's case, more than their family. Besides the son, obviously. He says he never loved anybody except his son. He's like, he didn't believe it was possible for a man to love a woman. I mean, that's how extreme he was, but he loved his cars. But anyways, I want to read this. This is where Disney's on the verge of a nervous breakdown before Disneyland. Okay. So there's also something in this book, not in this book, the other two books I read about him too. He's got towards the end of his career, at the end of every day on the studio lot, there's he has a professional masseuse. Her name is Hazel George. He meets with her every day, strips down naked, drinks scotch, and is massaged by this woman. She's the last person he ever says goodbye to when he leaves the studio for the last time. So I'm going to bring it. He's talking. I'm going to tell you what he's saying during one of these massage sessions. During their sessions in 1948, Hazel George, began to sense that her boss was sinking into what seemed to her to be a dangerous depression, perhaps a nervous breakdown. And this is not the first time in his career that this happened to him. He'd had one, or something like one, back in 1931. He said at that time that I had a hell of a breakdown. I went to pieces. I kept expecting more from the artist, and I got worried. I would just pound, pound, pound. Costs were going up, and it was always way over what they figured the picture would bring in. I just got very irritable. I got to a point that I couldn't talk on the telephone. I would begin to cry. Now it seemed again to be just pound, pound, pound. Once more, the money wasn't coming in. His last successful feature, Bambi, was 6 years in the past, and Cinderella was nowhere near finished. Disney was often aggrieved, abrupt, and when not angry, he was remote. And so it was this during this nervous breakdown, this depression, he starts spending less time at the studio, starts spending all this time building. He's going to call it the Lily Bell, named after his wife, this very realistic miniature railroad at the house he's building. It's got a tunnel. I mean, it's. I think he spent a couple $100,000 on this thing. And he's going to different places all across the country researching. He just became completely obsessed with locomotives and railroads. So he goes to this railroad fair with another one of his employees. And this is where he gets the blueprints. These are the early blueprints, the early inspiration for what he's eventually going to build at Disneyland. And it's at this railroad fair. And this his idea at the time, amusement parks were thought of like, you know, they're kind of ghetto, like shitty, just shitty places to go. Well, you'd have like theme parks built upon a theme that were temporary. And they'd usually be like a world fair or a fair, like in this case, a railroad fair. And this is where he's going to get a lot of ideas. So it says, what impressed him most was were the fair's ancillary exhibitions. One could see some of the spores that would blow into Disneyland in the guidebook's description. This is how they were marketing it. In its acres of exhibits, the railroad fair offers hours of fascinating enjoyment, intriguing pageantry, invaluable education, taken back to the early days when an unbelievable American... No, that's not... What's that word? I gotta go back on the page. Hold on. When an unbelieving American looked askance at the first wood-burning locomotive, you will move rapidly forward to the mammoth streamliners that's what they're calling the railroads, the modern railroads they're building, our locomotives, that beckon the way into our own tomorrow. Each exhibit will prove an exciting and entirely different chapter in a stirring melodrama. One railroad will take you into a primitive Indian countryside, another away to the playgrounds of Florida, or the romantic old French quarter of New Orleans. So you have this circle. Think of it like a wheel with spokes coming out. This is where you start, and then you have all these lands. That's exactly what Disneyland is, right? It talks about they're dressed up. If you're going to the French Quarter of New Orleans, the people are speaking the right language. They have the same uniforms on that people would have in the back of the day. So he really takes this idea and runs with it. There was gumbo to be had in the recreated French Quarter, and the people who served it were dressed in period costumes. The exhibits added up to a coherent whole. The growth of America told in three dimensions, a history lesson you could walk through. Although the term still lay in the future, Walt Disney was visiting a theme park. Kimball, that's who he's with, and Disney stayed at the fair for several days. And then they made another crucial stop on their way home at Henry Ford's 20-year-old Greenfield Village. I do not think Henry Ford's still alive at this time. As the richest American, he was able to collect on a titanic scale. So they're talking about the similarities between Henry Ford and Disney, and one similarity is that they are both nostalgic. So it talks about some of the things Ford purchased and sent to this Greenfield Village. He bought Thomas Edison's Menlo Park Laboratory. He collected the homes of people he admired. Noah Webster's, which is the slave cabin where George Washington Carver was born. Harvey Firestone's childhood farm. A courthouse where Abraham Lincoln practiced law. These are actual buildings. He literally bought them and had them transported over here. He acquired not only the Wright brothers' house, but the bicycle shop where they conducted their momentous experiments. Ford was not recreating the past. Instead, he was building a vision of what most appealed to him about it. Fordstown was an entirely... This is the main point of why I'm telling you this about the section. Fordstown was an entirely personal reflection of the man. So would Disney's be the roadmap of Walt Disney's life. So one thing Walt had to overcome is everybody... told him, it's like, this is a dumb idea. Why are you building an amusement park? They're terrible things. And I love this. Like, they're saying something that's true. At the time, amusement parks were terrible. He's like, that's the point. I have an opportunity because there's so much room for improvement. That's a very powerful idea. Why would you want to get involved in an amusement park? They're so dirty and not fun at all for grown-ups. Why would you want to get involved in a business like that? He fielded the question the way he would countless times during Disneyland's germination. That's exactly the point. Mine isn't going to be that way. Mine's going to be a place that's clean, where the whole family can do things together. And that part reminds me of what Henry Royce said about he's like, I didn't innovate when I was building a Rolls Royce. He's like, I just made every single part of that goes into an automobile better. And it was a combination of those improvements that created something entirely new. I feel that's what Disney was doing when he was building upon the lack of quality from amusement parks. Like, I'm going to improve every aspect of it, and I'm going to make it better. I'm going to make something new as a byproduct of that. This is how Walt described Disneyland a few years before it was built. Walt was quoted as saying, Disneyland will be something of a fair, an exhibition, a playground, a community center, a museum of living facts, and a showplace of beauty and magic. So as he gets going with the idea, he hires the Stanford Research Institute to find out where he should put the park. He has them doing the research and stuff. First, I thought it was really interesting, the two people they hired, their names are Woody and Buzz, which I found fascinating because, you know, 55 years later, Pixar is going to make a movie with the two main characters being Woody and Buzz, and then Disney's going to buy that company. I just thought it was really weird, or really interesting, rather. And this is what one of the guys, Buzz, his last name is Price, he's saying. He was like, this is a bizarre, this is his reaction to Disney's idea. So it says, it sounded strange, unlike anything you would expect in an amusement park. At the time when most parks were planned as a grid with four side access, Disney outlined a design concept of a single park entrance passing through a turn of the century Main Street, which would end in a circular plaza or town square. The area would then feed off radially into four thematic activity areas, the World of Tomorrow, Fantasyland, Frontierland, and Adventureland. Whereas most amusement parks wanted all the street visibility they could get, Walt's entire park would be hidden from the outside world. He was talking about customized rides, exhibits, and attractions instead of the standard off-the-shelf Ferris wheel and Tunnel of Love. Rides would be subordinate to story and setting. Most shockingly, there were no thrill rides. Price could not imagine such a place without the roller coaster. But most alarming, this entertainment anomaly had to be open in just 2 years. So once he secures the land in Anaheim, which is like just orange groves at the time, he's bringing a bunch of his friends out, you know, usually on 101, and he just brings them out there. The people he brings sees just a giant field, orange groves, right? But Disney is visualizing and telling the story of what he's going to transform this into. And this was funny to me. This is a friend's response to Disney's plan. While he talked, becoming more and more enthusiastic by the minute, I had begun to grow more and more concerned. I hardly knew how to tell him for once that he was making what would probably be the biggest, most ruinous mistake of his life. What could I say? I knew he was wrong. And I thought that was funny because that sentence, he's like, I knew Disney was wrong. I knew he was wrong. Everybody said that to him. So Disney sets up this secondary company outside of the Disney studio. He starts funding this. He sells his house. He borrows against his life insurance. Eventually, he's got to bring his brother into this because his brother is the one that always took care of finances for the main Disney company. And so his brother's name is Roy. And Roy just has a great way. He's telling the story about their relationship. He's Disney's older brother. And one, the story made me laugh. And two, it's a great way to think about Disney's, like, he would not give up his persistent personality, always pushing forward. It's very interesting. So it says, Roy Disney once told of an incident that happened back in the days 60 years earlier. Walt found a pocket knife. He was 5 years old and I was 13. I said, look, you can't trust yourself with a knife, you'll cut yourself. And I took the knife away from him. Roy was remembering this because the brothers had recently had a squabble, and Walt accused me of bullying him and throwing my weight around. And he says, you've been doing that since I was born. I remember you took that knife away from me. Roy saw the fraternal equation differently. When Walt and I were on the farm, we had to sleep in the same bed. Now, Walt was just a little guy, and he was always wetting the bed. And he's been peeing on me ever since. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to finish listening to this podcast, you'll need to upgrade to the Misfit feed. By upgrading, you get access to every full-length episode. There's no special app required. You listen to the Misfit feed in your favorite podcast player, just like every other podcast. It takes less than a minute to set up, and then you can start binging episodes and learning from some of the greatest minds in history. You can choose between the monthly or annual plan, and the annual plan is the best value at less than $1 a week. Founders is ad-free, and you can upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or by going to founderspodcast.com.